Hello and welcome to The Libertarian, a production of Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Law at the NYU School of Law, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, economic Armageddon, fact or fiction. Okay, Richard, we use that title because this week's podcast was inspired by an opinion piece that ran last weekend in the New York Times by David Stockman, the former Reagan budget director and congressman, and it ran under this ominous title, Sundown in America. And it was basically as bearish as you can get on America's economic prospects. It referred to America as in, and I'm quoting here, end-stage metastasis, and closed by telling readers to basically get out of the market and hoard their cash. And as you might expect, that's occasioned a lot of attention, as has the fact that he was aggressively critical of both Democrats and Republicans. So let's start by having you respond to some of his criticisms of what's gone wrong with the American economy.
Well, what happens is the best paragraph in this particular piece is the first paragraph where he tries to tell some of the things that have happened, which should give everybody a sense of unease, even if it does not necessarily lead to a doom. And so what he does, in effect, is he starts to talk about the sort of extensive increase in the total amount of public debt, which I think is a certain source of concern for everybody. He talks about the sustained consequences of having a zero interest rate policy, which starts to exist. He then shows that these have consequences for the larger economy, although the causation is not fully established, so that economic output has grown by, he says, 1.7% a year, which is about the rate of growth in population. And real business investment, he says, has crawled forward only at 0.8% a year. Payroll jobs turn out to be down under these things, and the number of full-time middle-class jobs are down as well. And the basic point that you have to make about that stuff is, I think that every one of those particular observations about the system at large is true, as are several others concerning, for example, the fundamental fragility of the pension systems in many, many states, which is evidenced by the now bankruptcy of the city of Stockton, California, where the Wall Street Journal opines, perhaps correctly, that bankruptcy is simply a way to make sure that secured creditors eat the burden, and the fat pensions to the police officers and other public union services remain intact. So, I mean, it's not as though when you read all of this thing that you can say, you know, the problem about you, Mr. Stockman, is you don't know how to count. None of these things have really happened. We're in great clover and everything is just fine. So if you looked at all of those points and you said to yourself, these are serious problems, what's the correct response? And here, he used two paths. One of them, you could say, you know, the system seems to be in steady state. It's not falling alarmingly. It's certainly not booming. So there got to be some positives on the other side. What are those? And then you try to identify them. That's not what he does. Instead, at that point, he kind of leads into something which is close to cloud cuckoo land. He goes back, you know, to the decision to get off the gold standard in 1934. He attacks Milton Friedman for his crazy financial and monetary policies.
Well, let's stay there. Let's stay there for a moment, Richard, because there is a lot of historical analysis in here that I know you take exception to. And in that section, he starts by saying, and I'm quoting here, the state wreck originated in 1933 when Franklin D. Roosevelt opted for fiat money, currently not fundamentally backed by gold. And he goes on to cite a couple of other mistakes that Roosevelt made. And then he says that Richard Nixon's decision to end the convertibility of gold to the dollar was, quote, arguably a sin graver than Watergate, and goes on to ding Milton Friedman for opening up the door to endless monetary expansion, as he calls it. So, you know, you hear this criticism a lot in recent years about the Fed and an out-of-control monetary policy, advocacy for returning to the gold standard. Does that carry any weight with you?
Not the gold standard, referring to a more sensible monetary policy, which essentially tries the amount of currency in circulation to the amount of real wealth generated by the economy so that prices are kept basically even and that interest rates sort of have a normal rate of between 1.5% and 2%, which reduces the need of private transactors to have special provisions to take into account the fact that the actual rate of inflation as measured in nominal dollars is either too high or too low. Deflation is totally ruinous because it means that somehow or other, when you pay back dollars, you're always paying back more than you receive because of the cheaper currencies. And that was one of the things that led to the serious problem in the Depression. So if I were to critique our friend Stockman on this, I would say the massive deflation, which led to the massive sets of defaults with respect to farm loans, which led to the bank crashes, were really very important. I would think that the gold stuff was relatively unimportant in comparison with that. So keeping a stable currency, I think, is something we want. And, of course, that's what Milton Friedman stressed. And to put it in another pass is, if you start with the gold standard as your nominal situation, you have to remember gold is also a commodity. You could have large new discoveries of gold, which could essentially cheapen it, or you could find that there are all sorts of new industrial uses for it, which means that there's not only a money component to it, but there's also a kind of an industrial component to it. And there's nothing which says that that kind of instability, in fact, gets you the kind of financial stability that you want. So the way to read Milton Friedman is he's saying, I'm giving you a market basket which includes in proportion just about every single commodity and service that we have in the United States. And if we could keep stable with respect to that, we will do fine, which means that the Fed has to exercise certain kinds of restraints in dealing with monetary policies so it doesn't cheapen the currency and let the flood in there. Now that we've done this, we got another puzzle. We certainly have added a lot of stuff to the marketplace. I'm not a fan of this, but we have seen for the most part that there's little or no inflation whatsoever. And at that point, there's a genuine policy problem that everybody has to explain. People like Paul Krugman says, look, it turns out that I was right. All of this stuff about worrying about the deficit and worrying about the flooding of money is not the real issue. The real issue is unemployment and jobs and other things like that, to which the response comes from a lot of sensible people that, this summer will not always last. And if you now have an increase in interest rates by 1% or 2%, the Fed will not be able to take all that money out of circulation by selling securities and trying to get cash backs. It will have too many competitors in that particular situation, and you're risking some serious kind of dislocations. And you don't have to be Stockman who's saying that everything is going wrong to sort of be along the lines of people like Alice Rivlin who say, this is something we ought to worry about. I wish the last time I heard her, she said, that Mr. Krugman had a little bit more modesty with respect to the confidence of his future proposals. But what Stockman said is just kind of crazy. He got Milton Friedman wrong. He overstated the importance of the gold situation. It does not show a real strong grasp of monetary theory. I don't regard this as an area of my obvious intellectual strength, but if I can figure out that he's gone way off the deep end, professionals in this area surely can confirm that, as I think for the most part they have.
How about this, Richard? After he relitigates a lot of 20th century American economic policy, he then gets closer to the present day, and Stockman stakes out a very aggressive position on TARP and the bailouts from 2008. He calls it in the piece the single most shameful chapter in American financial history, and he writes, let me read you the quote here, "There was never a remote threat of a Great Depression 2.0 or of a financial nuclear winter, contrary to the dire warnings of Ben Bernanke. The great fear manifested by the stock market plunge when the House voted down the TARP bailout before caving and passing it was purely another Wall Street concoction. The Main Street banking system was never in serious jeopardy. ATMs were not going dark, and the money market industry was not imploding." And of course, the confidence on display there couldn't be a bigger contrast to the utter uncertainty, and it's fair to say panic, feeling at the time. So is that too cavalier of an analysis, you think?
Well, I think it's way over the top. I mean, there was just an enormous dispute about the extent to which all of these interconnected financial obligations would create a house of cards or a domino, such that if one thing fell, the next one would fall. And a lot of the people who were in on the effort to try and construct these bailouts, they may have been wrong in some particular case, but I don't think you could say that they were frivolous or engaged in some kind of sinful activity. One of the criticisms that one makes, of course, of this is not that they were sort of fiendishly in service of every evil person on Wall Street, but rather the inconsistent treatment. So Bear Stearns is allowed to go by the side. Lehman Brothers goes by the side. AIG gets some kind of relief. And somebody says, look, you got to be a little bit more consistent in the way in which you play this thing, because that's a gratuitous element of uncertainty. And, the Fed may well have made a mistake because of the inconsistency in treatment. But again, inconsistency in treatment is not the sign of the incarnation of evil, which is the way in which Stockman wants to play things. So essentially, the guy essentially has a gear in which you say everything's a 10 or everything's a 0, where for most people looking at some of these very hard problems, there are a lot of 3, 4, 5, 6s, and 7s in the middle. And, it's not as though a libertarian says that when you're dealing with currency, there aren't some common mode failure risks that you have to take into account. It's rather that he just does not see the opposite side to any particular question. So he doesn't even address what really has to be done to deal with these issues on investment and on labor markets and on pension, because he's thinking always at much too much a grand level.
Well, on that point, for everything being a zero or a 10, and another interesting criticism of Stockman's, he targets specifically the man that a lot of people think of as the model of fiscal rectitude in government today, Paul Ryan. He calls it shameless that Ryan's newest budget gives Medicare and Social Security, in his words, a 10-year pass, and then calls the proposed cuts to Medicaid and food stamps and the earned income tax credit in that budget, which are, I think, 30% over 10 years, calls it draconian and another front in the GOP's war against the 99%. So I read that as Social Security and Medicare, too big of a problem to put off addressing, the safety net, too sacrosanct to touch, at least at the depth that Ryan intends. So how closely does that point of view track with Richard Epstein?
It doesn't track with anybody. I mean, look, every one of these programs has a certain degree of difficulty associated with it. It's very hard to figure out how you supply these transfer payments and keep people living to the standards that they would like to do so. But these are hard problems, even if you don't excoriate the top 1% for the supposed sins that they've done. Indeed, one of the problems is exactly the opposite. If you want to figure out who's winning in the tug of war politically, it's the many voters amongst the recipients who are outpolling the many dollars amongst those people who are now being asked to pay for this stuff, so that you get at the same time a denunciation of the system is pandering to the rich at the same time that you see there are huge numbers of dollars being taken from them, sent to other programs. We don't know whether keeping Medicare big or small is what he really wants, because he seems to talk about both things. We cannot run up the deficit, but on the other hand, all we have to do is to make sure that we service all these people who have entitlements. And so even in this material that you read, there's a sense in which he's talking out of both sides of his particular mouth. And there is absolutely nothing in any of this stuff which tells you what a policy prescription might be in order to deal with the situation. Now, for example, if you take Ryan, his premium support plan, which is patterned on the kinds of plans that have worked reasonably well in places like Indiana, is an effort of saying, look, we're not going to try and regulate this entire market baskets of services. We're going to give you a subsidy. You can spend it in whichever way you see fit, and people will compete in order to do it, and they won't be able to steal the subsidy from you because they know it's a finite good, and people will then compete away their efforts to get that subsidy, so is giving it basically a competitive rate of return in the marketplace. That was his original proposal, and you know the reason he hasn't been able to keep to it is you've got a president in office who announced that we'll never take away your Medicare benefits ever, and he has to work within that political reality that the president is opposed to any and all kinds of voucher programs, essentially because he thinks it's a winning play with his own constituents. So you can't sit out there as the moral absolutist on the one hand and take after pretty conscientious public servants who have to deal with a, shall we say, landscape, which is not ideal for the kinds of prescriptions that you deep in your heart believe. And Ryan is trying to work some kind of consensus bipartisan program. So I think at this point, it's Ryan 1 and Stockman 0, again, on the 0-1 scale that he seems to like to use.
Now, when you read this piece, you don't realize how badly Stockman wants to burn down the current system until you get to his sort of prescriptions at the end, what he calls sweeping constitutional surgery. And I'll just, this is a fairly lengthy list, but we'll dispense with it shortly just so you can react to it. These are some of his proposals. Amendments to give the president and members of Congress a single 6-year term with no reelection, 100% public financing for candidates, strictly limiting the duration of campaigns, which he arbitrarily throws out 8 weeks is the length of that, prohibiting for life lobbying by anyone who's been on a legislative or executive payroll, overturning Citizens United, mandating that Congress pass a balanced budget or face an automatic sequester of spending. So this is root and branch stuff. It's not just a couple pieces of legislation. I mean, it's structural.
Yeah, and some of it's structurally nuts. For example, the original Constitution said we want two houses of Congress with very different characteristics, one which is more stable and the other which is a little bit more responsive. So we have a 1/3 turnover in the one and 100% turnover in the other. And, you know, there's nothing about that judgment which says we're going to do better if, in fact, what we do is we make both of these things 6-year terms, because at that point, the differentiation and product diversification that you get disappears. It's also very clear that if you want to play term limits, the country has already spoken on this, and rightly so, 6 years is absurdly too short. My own proposal has been not two in the Senate and three in the House, which is what most of my libertarian friends like to say. I think, in effect, if you were to have 10 in the House and four in the Senate, that would completely transform the world, because you think of the mischief that everybody from Jesse Helms to Teddy Kennedy to Robert Byrd did, and you know, Jesse and so forth, after they had been in for 24, 25 years, you get rid of a lot of that excess and you still have some continuity. So he's wrong on that. At the other end of the list, he starts talking about Citizens United. He's, I think, clearly wrong on that. The somehow idea you're going to stop corporate speech sounds wonderful until you realize that the New York Times is a corporation. Well, then you want to exempt people from the press. Well, we don't know who the press is anymore, given the fact that we're doing this kind of podcast. And then if you look at the reality, the only people in the corporate world who want to be able to exercise this rights of speech are conscious lobbying organizations, the Cato Institute, the unions, the Chamber of Commerce. I could just report, I don't really think there was a single American corporation that actually signed the brief on behalf of the folks in Citizens United, which, of course, was not a standard business corporation. They're in the film business. All of these cases involving people like Wisconsin Right to Life are not mainstream corporations who get killed in the market for goodwill whenever they take a political position. They're small advocacy groups who should be allowed to speak in whatever form they start to see fit. You want to talk about a balanced budget amendment? I've got some sympathy with respect to that. But if you actually then think that the budget contains not only current expenditures but long-term capital items to it, do we really think that every time we want to build an asset that's going to have a 10 or 15-year life, we have to fund it out of current resources as opposed to borrowing against the particular asset and keeping our balance sheet in order, not by having a balanced budget in the particular year, but by, in effect, making sure that there are no general guarantees to specific projects so that the lenders know they can only look to the revenues from the projects, which means that the government's now going to have a much stronger incentives to make sure that those things can actually support the sorts of payments that are from them. So any one of these proposals, it strikes me, is just wrong. And so what's annoying about Mr. Stockman and this stuff is there are a lot of things he doesn't know the first thing about, as best I can tell. And his level of confidence across a wide range of issues is simply inexcusable for somebody who wants to talk seriously about public policy. And that's why you then look at this and just the last question. You go back to the indictment that he made in the beginning on the low grade of economic growth in the United States, right, and the high levels of unemployment. He never talks about the deregulation of labor markets. He never talks about what you're supposed to do with respect to Dodd-Frank and the regulations of the banks and these things. So you get this peculiar lack of matching in which the proposals seem to come out of laundry baskets in one place, and they don't relate to the particular problems that you start to see. So the disconnect is really quite striking.
Richard Epstein, thank you as always. And a reminder to our listeners, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by going to hoover.org and clicking on Defining Ideas. And you can follow Richard on Twitter @RichardAEpstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.